everyone. I'm Lindsay Cuiava, the host of Flipping the Script, a podcast all about creating theater for modern audiences and inspiring you to make art that matters in your community. As a dramaturg and theater consultant, I see all the time how theater makers are stuck creating art that is sterilized and lacks connection to their communities, and especially lacks connection to young people. For the past decade, I have worked in conservative small towns and in liberal urban centers to create theater that engages audiences and brings communities together in impactful ways. Through this podcast, I am so excited to bring you awesome conversations around hot topics in theater today, slightly sassy commentary, a little bit of butt kicking, and inspiration to make art that matters. This week, I'm joined by my dear friend and one of my favorite people to collaborate with, Kate Yeager. Kate is a director and actor and teaching artist in the Seattle area. And while there are so many ways that we probably should have met, the way that we met was actually teaching drama camp to kindergartners, which is something that I had never done before, and I don't believe either of us has done since, because we generally work with middle school and high school students. We just both had a free summer and ended up being teaching partners. And what should have been a really stressful and crazy summer because, wow, elementary school teachers, I give you so much credit. Kids are absolutely insane. And while it should have been just a kind of a wash as far as a career development, meeting Kate was super important and impactful to me as an artist in the Seattle area because I got to know more about her and the work that she's doing and find somebody I felt a kindred spirit with. So one of the things that I really love about Kate and the work that she creates is that she really leads with her heart, but in a way that encourages action and growth. She believes that empathy is the thing that is going to heal this world, and I totally am behind her on that statement, and that is the way that she approaches all of her work. So in recent years, Kate has really taken to telling stories that we are really familiar with in a way that relates to modern audiences and to the students. So I wanted to bring her on to talk about her work and how she's approaching these stories that we all know and love and bringing them to light in a new way that doesn't change the script at all. Oh, and one last thing. In the podcast, we keep saying that Kate's masterclass is next week. Well, we had some technical difficulties in recording episode 3, so we bumped Kate's up. And so the masterclass that we talk about is actually on February 23rd. Which is 2 Saturdays from now. Okay, enjoy the show. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm really excited that you're here for this episode of Flipping the Script. I am joined by one of my absolute favorite people who I feel like just always were on the same page doing theater, which is super exciting because I don't usually find that. People usually think I'm too over analytical or something. So today I am joined by Kate Yeager, who is an awesome actor and director in the Seattle area. She's also a fantastic teaching artist and just an awesome human. So,
stop it some more. Wow.
Yeah, so thanks for joining us, Kate.
It's my pleasure. Yes. I enjoy being here. We're sort of the bad girls of educational theater.
That's kind of true.
Breaking all the rules.
I feel like we do get people riled up a little bit. But then people also really do, then they'll be like, oh, but you guys are like, you know, doing things that are very good.
It's true.
And sometimes I wish that was reflected in my paycheck, but...
Oh, well, also that. Yes.
I think it's okay.
I think that both you and I could define sort of our ethos as not being satisfied with being told, well, that's just the way it's always been done.
Oh, absolutely not.
And the fact that, like, just like the name of this podcast, what?
Oh, my gosh.
That we have in our own power to flip the script and to change the way that we look at educational theater and the way that we look at theater in general and just the way we even interact with our students and treat them and recognize their humanity.
What?
I know.
What a weird concept.
It's the worst.
I know. Gosh, that's so funny. I came from a meeting today where literally was constantly being told like how teachers just don't value that their students have voice and that they are empowered. And it just, it riled me up, and I had to like take deep breaths and listen to calming music on the ride home before we did this podcast, because that's actually not what the podcast is about this time. So I'm sure we will have conversations about it in the future.
It's true.
Because I think one of the things if you've worked with me or you know me, you've heard me talk about with Kate that I particularly admire is the way that she runs a rehearsal room where students are fully empowered, but they don't overrun the process, and that there's no yelling.
Yes, I don't like to yell because, first of all, I have a very delicate instrument. but also, I just don't I don't believe in getting results that are based out of fear, because those don't feel great for me to have gotten them that way. And also, that's not the kind of change that matters or sticks. I would rather have buy-in and have participation where everybody feels ownership over the process. And when I first start talking about this, and again, that's not what this actual podcast is
about.
Okay,
we can tangent.
But, it would seem that it would lend itself to chaos, and it does not. I have a very collaborative room, but I also have a very good handle on what is happening, and I have overall say and things like that. But it's about, for me, directing from a place of yes, and knowing that when students have ideas, it's not because there's some punk that thinks they know better than me or because I haven't done. I think I had to get over the idea of if somebody had an idea, especially if it was a student, that it would make me look weak, and as though I didn't have that idea, so therefore, like, what was wrong with me?
Oh.
But that's impossible, because the whole thing about theater is that it is collaboration. And it's collaboration at every single step. I mean, when you first get that script, you don't have the author usually right in front of you to talk about. So the collaboration is, here are the words that I've given you. Now you collaborate with the spirit of how you take those words. And for me, I'm always telling the kids that my job is to keep an eye on the big picture and to make sure that the overarching story is clear and that we all know what story we're telling. Because I can't tell you how many times kids don't really know what story they're telling. You know, like
all the time.
That somehow it cannot be emphasized enough how important I think table work is and just sitting down, even if it's just before you block the scene, read it once, and find out if they know what's going on.
Yes.
Because, you know, I think especially, well, most young actors are like so eager to please that admitting that they don't quite understand a word or what's going on is just not possible for that.
Totally. Yeah.
So leaving room for that and creating space where it's okay to talk about what's going on and to have questions and to, you know, I had a student, we were doing Les Mis and there was it's Thénardier and he has to say something about décolletage, which, if you don't know, is a fancy word for basically cleavage, seeing, you know, the cleavage of a person. And part of why it's, you know, it's a joke in the song.
Right.
And it very quickly became clear that he had no idea what décolletage was. And I was like, do you know what that means? He's like, is it like a shirt? And I was like, oh no, it is actually the opposite of a shirt, which would be why we're having this conversation. So, you know,
yes.
So it's making sure that, you know, everybody's on the same page, but also just recognizing that when someone is filled with a spark of an idea, that is usually born out of connection. And it's because they suddenly are connecting with the material in a new way and it sparks an idea.
Yeah.
And I want to leave room for those moments to happen. And I try to have a room that, you know, I have the guiding hand on, but I'm trying to take my ego out of it.
Which you do so well.
Thank you.
And that's so hard, I think, as a director, to take your ego out. And I mean, I see all the time that's what overrides a lot of programs and a lot of directors is their ego. And it usually ends in some kind of a dumpster fire.
Right.
And I'll
say that my, you know, it's born out of being an actor as well. I, mm-hmm. a few years back, had a really toxic experience with a director who really messed with my confidence, and mm-hmm. I almost quit acting and all theater together. Like, oh my gosh. It was one of those things where everything out of my mouth, literally like 30 seconds in, he'd say, "What is that? That's not a choice. Nobody does that. That's not a thing people do."
What?
And like every sort of choice I was making was questioned, not just as a like, that's a good choice for this show or not, but like, that's not a thing a human person does, or why would you even think that thought? You know, just
wild.
Yeah. And it got into my head, and it made me feel, it made me second guess all of my, you know, it was a big show for me that like, you know, at a really big theater. And so like,
yeah.
I just allowed myself to get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller through the process. And I suddenly just had this epiphany of, I didn't want to talk about decision or, you know, choices anymore on stage as being good or bad.
Mm.
I wanted to talk to them about being helpful or stronger when it comes to telling our overall story.
That's because it's so smart.
Because the choice you make is almost certainly a possible choice that character could make, but it may not help us to tell the journey of that character, or it may not help us to tell that overall journey of the entire story, and to speak of it in those terms rather than the value judgment of your ideas are bad, therefore you are bad.
Right, yeah. Well, that's, I think, man, if you're listening, I hope that you jot that down, because I think that's a really great way to talk with students, because students oftentimes are scared to make choices, which is fascinating too, having watched you, because I've also seen a lot of those students in other settings, and they don't make choices as well as with the way that you create your space and the way that you empower your students. And I love it. And that's why, I mean, you work with me at ReTheater as our directing mentor for that direct reason. I'm sure we'll have like a whole podcast, because I mean, probably several, because that's something I think is a great tool for directors to have and to implement in their programs. I think it will just grow your program in such crazy ways, and there will be some growing pains.
Yeah.
And you really do have to check your ego. But you really will help students actually act and not just be performers. Yeah. And I think that's a really big thing. Yeah.
You just made me so happy. Cause that's, you know, I, it all for me comes into like, I don't think process and product are two separate things. Mm-hmm. I think they go hand in hand. And when you invest in the process and you invest in young actors and help them to grow their skills and the things that we're learning in the classroom and then put them into actual practice on stage,
yes.
How amazing is that? And then you get better buy-in, and they are part of that process and they feel ownership. And then guess what? The product is better.
Oh my gosh. for sure. I mean, yeah. That's like all I do with my life is getting people to see that how that process works. And it is a challenge, but it's totally worth it in the long run. And hopefully, I mean, that's why this podcast is here, is to inspire you to make art that matters with your students and in your communities.
And we figured we should just start recording the conversations we have on the regular.
Anyway. We really should. Like when we just go to, we'll just like bring all the recording stuff into Starbucks and be like, here we go. So that's actually a really great segue though. Not Starbucks, but the last point that we had about process versus product and getting the buy-in from students, because I really wanted to talk about today was how your passion behind creating work from found material that's really relevant to students.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like the one area that you and I are not always on the same page, because I'm pretty quick to be like, well, that show just shouldn't be done anymore because it's not relevant.
Cancel it.
Like, or just like very, and I know this about myself, and I check myself before I just usually like, nope, don't do that show. Don't do My Fair Lady because it's a terrible show that's super misogynistic. Don't do it. But My Fair Lady also is great music and is a beautiful story.
Yes.
So,
and can be told in a way that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like, yeah. So great segue.
Like, right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and you've done amazing work with this and are so dedicated to it as a director. So I wanted to start by asking why, like, where did this passion come from with you to not just do, I don't know, I guess one of the shows you did is Beauty and the Beast, and not just do Disney's Beauty and the Beast, but to really make it something that related to the students. It's not it's not a story that I would be like, oh, that's a super relatable thing for high school students. but then when you talk about it, I was like, well, how stupid am I to not have realized this? So like, where does that passion come from?
Yeah. Part of it is I feel like I need to know why I'm telling the story I'm telling. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why am I telling it?
Yeah.
and I very rarely do, I should say that I fully believe in and love what I will term like the popcorn musicals or the popcorn plays, which are things that are mostly just like uplifting, make you happy, like, yes, give me some of that. It's
like Rock of Ages.
Yes. You know, like
great, like,
not that did, like, if you do that with high school kids, you'll have to talk about some of the issues and but in general, like, I need to, even with those, I need to have the reason, underlying story and the ethos and the reason.
This is why we're friends.
Yes. So, like, if I'm doing, for instance, when I do Seussical, I actually approach it very similarly to when I approach Beauty and the Beast or mm-hmm. as I approach, like, Les Mis.
Yeah.
Because at the center of those stories are protagonists who are feeling othered. Mm-hmm. That they have been labeled by society as the other, and their journey is to find themselves either through the eye, like seeing themselves through the eye of another person, or through like learning empathy or whatever, mm-hmm. or just like the other people around them, like in Seussical, like they are the ones that actually end up changing to become right. more to Horton's point of view. So I don't want to do Beauty and the Beast and have it be about a beast and at its worst and at its most easiest, that show really quickly becomes about Stockholm Syndrome and really uncomfortable message.
Right.
At its best, it is a story about two lost souls mm-hmm. who have been told again and again that they are not welcome for various reasons. For the Beast, it is because of the way he looks and he's been ostracized and sent away. For Belle, it is that she is a young woman who is curious and wants to read and wants to choose who she marries. Thank you very much. and that then when they find each other, yes, the circumstances involve some mild kidnapping. However, for me, it is about the friendship that grows for them mm-hmm. and that it is seeing each other through each other's eyes. Like, mm-hmm. I see the way you see me, and that's not the way I see myself. Mm. Oh. And also, like, learning empathy by watching, you know, he learns to be more empathetic as he watches her relate to the other people, in the castle. And that opens him up. And I think they get things from each other. I think... Yeah. It was important for me, like, along, you know, terms, like, that Belle, when the wolves came, like, was an active part of that fight, and that, you know, it was just because there were too many wolves. That's why Beast had to come in. There's just too many wolves, Lindsay. So, yeah, like, I don't want to just tell, like, this... I'll throw you a great Stanislavski quote.
Oh, please do.
Which I'm going to misquote, I'm sure.
That's fine.
But the gist of it is that people go to see live theater for the subtext because otherwise you would just stay home and read the play. Yeah. And if I'm just going to produce, you know, the normal version of Beauty and the Beast, like just stay home and watch the cartoon or watch the anime, you know, like...
That's so true.
Like I don't... That's already been done. I need to tell my version. And for me... I'm always constantly coming back to the fact that high school is really hard, and it is where a lot of who we are going to be as adults is set in motion mm-hmm. And solidified. Mm-hmm. And if I can help spread empathy and help in the practice of how we see through other people's eyes, that's giving a valuable skill that is often left off the table.
Right. Well, like, what class do you learn that in?
Right.
None. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's, that quote and then your analysis of it is probably, I just realized, like, why I just don't generally like going and seeing theater.
Right.
I get really anxious Just having to sit somewhere, probably because of my horrible attention span because of technology. Right. But I just also feel like no reason to sit and watch something that's just has no thought behind it.
And I think it's not that I think that everything needs to have, a big like twist to it, you know, like, it's not that I believe that all Shakespeare should be set in the modern era. Like I don't, like I love takes on Shakespeare. I also love, you know, Shakespeare that's done in period, but it needs to have a point of view. If a show doesn't have a point of view, and it needs to be a production-wide point of view, and everybody needs to be on that point of view.
Ooh,
and what I find is, so often, it's easy to just assume everybody knows where we're going and why we're going there and what direction we're headed.
Right.
But oftentimes, as directors, you know, we're focused on so many big picture things that we can forget to channel even the simplest of information of, oh, by the way, I think the theme of this show is this,
right.
You know, is X. And if we haven't even established what our baseline sort of story is that we're telling, then how are we ever going to tell the same story?
Right.
For instance, like if I'm just like, it's game night, everybody, and I just dump a bunch of game pieces on the floor and we don't know what game we're playing, it's going to be a real awkward game night.
Oh my gosh.
It may end up being fascinating, but I don't know how much help it will do us. So just, you know, at the very least, put the picture of the puzzle, you know, on the box so that we can see what we're trying to build.
Right. I mean, that's a really great analogy. And having worked on you with Les Mis with you, that was one of the things that was, I mean, as a dramaturg, made my heart just so happy that we started our first production meeting by you going very clearly through your point of view with that show. Which was, I think, I haven't worked with somebody who's taken that same point of view, and I don't know that I can pinpoint that I've seen a production with that point of view told, which we're going to take a quick break, and I want to come back from the break and talk more about point of view and how that can be applied to really make a show your own.
I can't wait. I hope I'm still here.
I hope so too. You'll have to wait in suspense to see if Kate is still here. Okay, I'll be right back. Everyone, if you're enjoying this conversation with Kate and you want to get to know her more or the work that she does or how she approaches work, I would love to invite you to join us for a masterclass that Kate is hosting through Re Theater on Saturday, February 23rd. This masterclass is going to look all at character development, which you guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I am constantly struggling with my students to help them take the character off of the page and translate it onto the stage. Everybody approaches character development differently, so you're always guessing what's going to work for your students, and Kate has been doing a ton of research around this, creating new techniques and new curriculum that she's been using in her acting classes and in her rehearsal rooms, and I can't wait for her to share it with us all. You guys, if you are an educator or a theater maker that really wants to make sure that your program is making an impact and that your students are getting the most out of character development from understanding human relationships and human psychology and creating interesting action on stage, then you cannot miss this masterclass. It is going to be incredible, and it's going to give you so many ideas of how you can use character development in your classroom and in the rehearsal room. So the masterclass, like I said, is on Saturday, February 23rd. It's online. If you can't join us live, that's okay. We will send you a recording of the class, whether you're there in person or not, and you'll have the opportunity to submit questions ahead of time so that regardless of if you're there, your questions will still be answered. You can find out all the details at the link in the show notes. And for our podcast listeners, we have a special code for 20% off that can be applied to Kate's masterclass. Just use code FTSPODCAST at checkout to get 20% off. You guys, I can't wait for this, and I hope to see you there. Great. Well, thanks everybody for coming back after that break. So yeah, before the break, we were talking about point of view.
Yeah.
And I think that is the entry point that you take when you come into your work to tell these stories through unique lenses. So I was wondering if you could just talk to us about about point of view and how that can then inform the way that you tell a story differently without mm-hmm. changing anything.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll use Les Mis and Beauty and the Beast as examples, because both of those are shows that I'd say generally are not seen as overly problematic, you know,
right.
much, you know, like, we're not talking about Carousel, which we could have a whole podcast about right. Carousel in general and like what you do with
yeah,
that.
Right.
However, each of them has potentially problematic moments mm-hmm. for now. Beauty and the Beast, for instance, you know, I directed that like 2 or 3 years ago and suddenly realized that like trying to put the song Me, which is where Gaston won't let Belle go, basically just stalks her and like won't let her leave the situation and says, you belong to me. And it's very possessive and it's supposed to be really funny, right? It's this funny song. How funny is that? and it is funny to a certain extent. And I get the, how it was written and it just doesn't work now, at least for me, like trying to put that on in the like jokey way was just not fitting well for me, especially seeing, you know, these young actors on stage and what story am I telling and what am I propagating if I tell this? So, the young actor playing Belle, we had a great sit down and we talked about like situations where we've experienced that with, people in our personal space and then particularly, men coming in and not taking no for an answer and what sort of tactics, women can use sometimes in order to sort of get through those moments and sort of protect themselves. And we talked about sometimes how we it might feel safer to play along or like at least placate.
Yeah.
And so in the song itself, he's doing all, you know, being ridiculous and twirling her around. And every time he would twirl her away, we would have a moment where she would just have this face of like, are you friggin' kidding me? I'm gonna vomit in my mouth, this dude. And then he would turn her to him and she would give him this really cheesy fake smile.
Yeah.
That was very clear that she was letting him feel powerful for a moment. And then the moment that she could get away from him, she took back her, you know. Now, is that the perfect story to tell? No. Hopefully the best story would be like, he came and he said, hey, girl, and she was like, no. And then he said, I respect that, and left. But that's not our story, right? Our story is about a flawed person, Gaston, who won't take no for an answer. He is our villain. So how do we make that moment palatable?
Yeah.
And how do we survive that in 2019? Well, you need to give Belle as much agency and as much power as possible.
Yeah.
And that, for me, also included, you know, having her be a big active part of the castle fight and making sure that at every step along the way, she had agency and she had control. For Les Mis, for me, I wanted to tell that story about the students. Mm-hmm. I think that so often, especially because we do that show and it's set so far in the past and it's set in another country and it's easy for us to separate ourselves out and sort of be like, well, those gallant, you know, young soldiers. And it's like, no, they're the same age as the students in my program.
Yeah, and that was crazy to see that make sense, to click with the students.
Yes.
Because I was a dramaturg on Les Mis, so just as you're listening, that's why I can jump in a little bit more. Continue.
Well, for me, it's absolutely, of course, it's Valjean's story of redemption and of grace and of all of those things. But it's I didn't want to lose the sacrifice of these students using their privilege for others.
Mm-hmm.
Because in general, you've got some well-to-do students who the things they were fighting for didn't affect them necessarily.
Right.
Like they were mad about what was happening in society and they took action. And so we took the lens of student activists through history.
Mm-hmm.
And Lindsay, who is BT Dubs, like the best dramaturg I've ever worked with, hands down.
Oh my gosh,
like so good. Really helped to set that foundation. And so we went through history and mm-hmm. we started way back and then we got really personal. And we talked about, you know, Parkland and the students who have become these activists and voices. And we had this wall of, what did we call it? The wall of, revolution and...
I wasn't there when you guys were using it. So
we had a wall where they could just come and put pictures, quotes, mm-hmm. anything. And it was like, half the wall was revolution and half the wall was empathy related and like worldview, sort of how do we see other people. Mm-hmm. And they would just came in with the most amazing pictures and doing their own research on,
oh my gosh,
you know, on military coups that involved students or about like just small, tiny little led student protests that like changed the name of the newspaper, you know, just like the most ridiculous things. But they bought in and their tie into that story and what was at stake and the loss and the courage and the what was it? This is where I start to get old. They were full of such courage, but also so much like naivete and like also a fair sense of like, well, I can do anything I want for I am a young, rich white man, right. You know,
yes.
Which is also a change that I really wanted to make for Les Mis, to make this a story that resonated for our students,
mm-hmm.
Was I didn't want the revolution to be full of just a bunch of white dudes. And so I really wanted my revolution to look at what I think the revolution looks like now. And when I say that, I did not lead the children in revolution. I just more in terms of like what my student body looks like, what the world looks like. And mm-hmm. so my students, my revolutionaries, were primarily female identifying and actors of color and non-binary, and just making sure that we had a really diverse group of people to tell that story. Angel Ross was a woman, which was amazing.
It was having, fantastic.
And my Javert was a woman, which people were nervous about, and ended up being so amazingly powerful and incredible. However, with that change, I had to make sure that I wasn't doing any unintentional storytelling.
Yeah.
Because every time you sort of look at casting in a different way or like what story you're telling, it's not enough to just be like, I'm just gonna shake things up.
No.
Pow! And let it fall where it may. Because, for instance, in Les Mis, there's a moment where Jean Valjean and Javert have a big confrontation, and it's supposed to get physical, and
right.
you know, Jean Valjean's supposed to overpower Javert. And optically, here I had this male identified body on stage, potentially beating up a female identified body on stage. And like, ooh. What story does that tell?
Right.
But I wanted Javert to have her strength and power. So we had it be more about the tension of a potential escalation.
Yeah.
That was then very quickly subdued by the arrival of nuns. Because you have two, you know, in the show, religious characters who would not come to blows in front of nuns.
Yeah.
And what it did was help take the story. I had the nuns come in and focus on the body of Fantine. And what mm-hmm. it did was it refocused that scene from the violent moment to the why we're fighting for what we're fighting.
Yeah.
And it brought it back to the stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought it back to the, I have to do this because this dead woman asked me to save her child, and the, I have to do this because this is the law and that is the only thing I have to guide me.
Yeah.
And that's the stakes of the century, mm-hmm. right? You're not gonna ever come to an understanding on that. So,
no.
So just finding ways to tell those stories. Doing Lovely Ladies was also like really difficult right now. You know, mm-hmm. we're in this time where we're being really aware, goodness of harassment and about Me Too and all of those things that, so when we started to put together Lovely Ladies, which again can be a very funny, you know, or has like some maudlin sort of humor to it, watching these
I just remembered like when we were in that rehearsal it was clear. So one of my jobs is just listen and identify when kids did not know what they were saying, and so when they said even stokers need a little stoke,
And the kid clearly didn't understand what that was. So yeah. I got to explain that.
Yeah.
To the whole group.
The whole group, yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, I have no shame, and that's right. why I like being a dramaturg and educator, because...
Well, and I think we have to, like, anytime there's a double entendre, I call it out. I say, and yes, that is a sex joke, everyone. Because, like, it's let's get it over with. Right. Let's also demystify it. Let's educate.
Well, and I think it gave those three young men who had to say those lines... It gave them an opportunity to just actually act in that moment yeah. rather than that, like, does everybody yeah. know what I'm saying? Do I even know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. So anyways, yeah. but no, continue, because this lovely lady thing was really great
yeah.
that she did.
So I started with an idea that was a little more realistic, mm-hmm. and very quickly I realized that was not going to work. Not now, and not with those young actors, etc. And right. so again, we twisted it around, and we gave a lot of agency to the women on stage. I gave the it's called pimp, so there it is, the pimp role to a young woman, and made her the madam, and actually made her be really careful about keeping an eye on all of the women, always knowing where they were going, always mm-hmm. clocking that they were coming back, creating sort of that idea of protection. And yes, of course, like we talked about, we sat down and we talked about why people are driven to that kind of work, what it means, what the reality is, how so often, especially during that time, it was because you had literally no other choice.
Right.
And that the women would oftentimes sort of be each other's form of protection. And so we just, mm-hmm. and then we also, for the young men that I had in that scene, I turned them away from the audience mm-hmm. so that they mm-hmm. really just became silhouettes, and they became nameless, faceless entities that entered in and out of the situation, but that the storytelling was really driven by the women and their relationships with each other. And it ended up, I think, really beautiful and really... Yeah,
it totally changed the scene from how I have seen it done in the past, because it is normally played pretty funny.
Kind of funny, yeah.
Which always has been confusing, because the stakes get raised so very quickly after.
So incredibly high, yeah.
But I think it's that because the men were the main actors in that moment. Like, they were the ones that were taking the specific actions. And mm-hmm. then we were almost mocking the women because they sing in that really screechy. Right. And I'm
1,000%. Yeah. yeah.
And I think that one of the things in that production that really stood out and we had talked about was that you really also wanted to look at how we fight systems of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And that came so clearly in this show and was a really interesting point, I think, for the students to enter it from. I mean, the storyline between Javert and Valjean became much less about these two parallels of a person, and much more about, like, power.
Yeah.
And how does that work? And where is the right and wrong? Which I was like, I don't know, because Valjean and Javert are just, like, mirrors of each other. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how is that going to work? But the focus was on the systems of power. And Lovely Ladies was another example of that. And I think that overall, you did a really great job of having the kids understand
mm-hmm.
what the systems were. And we did a little bit of work with that,
yeah.
but not a ton. Like, yeah. it wasn't like I was in there, like, doing dramaturgy work for hours and hours all the time with the kids. But that was super interesting to see. And I think it read very differently and in a way that really connected with the students.
Yeah. We started really early on with some really simple power exercises mm-hmm. in terms of status, like doing the putting the card on your head,
yeah.
forehead, and the way people treat you. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a lower number, people treat you poorly. And if you have a higher number and you don't know what you are, but you sort of learn what kind of power you have based on the way other people treat you. And then we took that idea and we talked about that a lot. So, like, we would read scenes, and as we would be talking about them, we would talk about, so who has the power in this scene and why do they have the power?
Mm.
And we, you know, we talked a lot about sort of how oftentimes people have power because they've been gifted that power. And,
right.
and then what's the difference between that and someone who comes and takes power, and, like, what happens, like, what is their power in not engaging, and like what power do you have by making a different choice? You know, it was important for me to have Cosette have some semblance of power, you know, yes. because she is written so poorly. And I mean, she's written of the time, and she's underwritten, yeah. and what are you going to do? so, you know, we did what we could, but I had her, you know, when Marius sees her in the garden the first time, I actually had her climb over the garden gate to get to him as he's climbing into the garden to get to her so that they're on the opposite, so that it was, they're both reaching for each other.
Yeah.
And then I had her during One Day More at the end of Act One, have a very clear like moment with him where she was basically, you know, as she's singing to him, giving him the impression, you need to do this, and yeah. I know you need to do this, and I love you, and you've got to go.
Right.
So that it was, again, giving her some emotional stake in the stakes that are, because otherwise her story is let them eat cake a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Because she's so removed from the danger and from what's happening in the world.
Yeah, and then we just see her cry at the end, and we're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I have no connection to you.
We gave her a really lovely path early on in when she would be visiting the cities, that like she was this woman who would go and visit the poor and
yeah.
you know, and be affected by them, and that she had a very clear understanding that the world around her was not her privileged world behind yeah. it, and that's part of why she wants to escape, right? Mm-hmm. Is it's not like just about, oh my god, that boy is so cute. It's, I need to know what's going on in the world. You can't keep me from it forever.
Right. Yeah. And that read really, really well. I mean, she's still like one of my least favorite characters on stage, but
I'm never going to make you love her. Cause yeah. she's hard to motivate. But
you did a really great job of giving that actor agency and not just being a beautiful soprano on stage. And I think that the one thing that I think at the pinnacle of this is that your ability to, and I don't even know if you necessarily understand it, but like from a dramaturgical standpoint of audience analysis and like, how does that all work? Your number one audience is always the students that are involved. Mm. Like that is the number one audience. And that is what at its core education theater is. Your number one audience is your students. Then it is the adults that are involved. Then it is the student. If you're in a school, it's like the students at large. Then it's the parents and acquaintances that are coming. And then finally, the community at large.
Hmm.
And
I love that.
Yeah, it's Howard, I didn't make it up, Howard
yeah.
Sherman
yeah.
did. And it was quoted in an article. And so that, though, is the key, I believe,
yeah.
to actual success and getting kids to buy into your program, to buy into the show that you're doing. Those kids were so invested in Les Mis, which is, and not just because, oh my gosh, we get to do Les Mis, which is why they were all so excited yeah. to begin with, but because they truly believed that the story that they were telling was so important today, yeah. which it is.
Yeah. And I will say, I think I can say this without without sounding like too much of a selfish jerk or
like
arrogant jerk.
I'll tell you if you sound like it.
But I would say like, I had similar buy-in and excitement to tell Seussical, right?
Yeah.
Because we were telling this story about love and this story about community and this story about finding your voice, and they saw themselves in that. And if your students can't recognize themselves in the characters, then it's never going to be the kind of production that you want it to be.
Right.
And the important thing I have learned with Les Mis is you have to be really clear on where your similarities with a character are, but also what your differences of the character are.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because Les Mis, Lindsay knows, like, it's an emotional show, and it got real emotional for the students in terms of they connected so much with the characters that we ended up having to really make sure that we were keeping clear boundaries between, like,
yeah,
what is this story and what is our story? And we found ways to work together. You know, we did journaling and we had dance parties and we pretty much we would do a lot of Beyonce dancing whenever things yeah. would get really awkward or just heavy.
Right.
The current show I'm working on right now is a show about literally about school bullying,
yeah.
and it is rough
intense.
And intense,
yeah.
and everyone is really struggling because they have to say these awful things to each other. So we've taken to, it's going to sound very, but we we stand away from each other and we just paw at the air and we say, I'm petting your aura, which is just, I'm petting your aura to just remind, and you do it all around the room to remind everybody that we're like, that we really love each other. And then we pet towards our tongue and we pet out the gross words that we just had to say. And then we pet out our ears from all the gross things we just had to hear. And then we just start it. And they think it's ridiculous, but they also love it because it's ridiculous.
Right.
And it actually, I think, helps because it takes it from that gross moment after someone's just called, you know, an actor of size, hey, Barney, and like, oh, how do you, oh, that's
so awful. And these kids are like friends.
And they're also the nicest kids. Yeah. Like, thank goodness.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, I definitely would like to talk to you more about how do we emotionally make sure our children are safe when we're teaching them acting.
Well, I will say, like, when you really endeavor to help them connect with the characters and to make it have an impact in their lives, then you have to be aware of the risk of it becoming so ingrained and so enmeshed and so lost in the pain or pathos that the lines get blurry.
Right. I think when you combine Meisner techniques or similar things with also trying to make it very, very relevant to students.
Yeah, I would not want to do that because that's too painful and too hard.
Well, and I think Meisner, and I'm sure there's people who would be like, oh, you're a horrible person.
Lindsay and I have opinions.
Yeah, I think I've already said how much I really despise Meisner, and it's only the third episode.
I think that there are lessons to be learned.
Totally.
And it is a wonderful thing to have in your toolbox, but it should be taught by people who are super trained in it, and it should not be for a certain, there are many undergrad programs that do not allow Meisner to be taught, so there you go.
You're so much more diplomatic about it. I know. I'm just like, this is the worst. and Kate's like cleaning off the table, being like,
and you know that in general, like, I do, there are exercises that I will use, but absolutely. Holy moly, as part
like
of a...
Like repetition
as
stuff?
As part of a toolbox of skills.
Like, I love the repetition exercises. I don't love when you have to, like, make the, like, obvious, like, you turn around and you're like, you have a big nose. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I do? That's what somebody said to me. And then after they're like, you don't really at all. Because I'm like, I thought my nose was like abnormally small, actually.
I know.
But like, that's so harmful. But I think that Meisner, my understanding of Meisner is not correct, but because I'm very biased. But I think Meisner is used as a tool to enter into material that is non-relatable to you. Like when you're entering into characters who you just don't have that connection with, that you have to use it. And also when you have to solely rely on emotion to tell a character, and that's not the way that I view acting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I view that you are an artist, and artists are activists, and there's a greater point behind just showing emotion on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And that everybody agrees.
And I always, like, my phrase for them is, like, you shouldn't have to open a vein on stage in order to, and there are ways that, you know, if you're struggling to tap into an emotion or to really understand the point of view, you may need a more intensive exercise to take you there. But then you need to be really safely taken back out of there.
Yes.
And that's where the problem comes often, is that oftentimes we'll lead exercises that bring up really, you know, I've been in the room where people have recovered memories that are real bad. Mm-hmm. And not in a group that I was leading, but actually as a teenager, I was in a group and it was community theater and this director who just really wanted to be like I'm gonna be so edgy, and it was almost all teenagers in the cast, and I mean fetal position on the floor, this person could not recover, and then we were just sent home, like rehearsal was over and we were just done, and there was no follow-up, there was no, you know, there was nothing, and it was just watching somebody fall to pieces with literally no one to pick them up afterwards. And it's Lindsay horrible. Knows this story. It was, I don't know if you remember exactly what this story is, but it was a Mother Goose Park
play. Oh, yes, play. Yes, yes.
We were rehearsing to do a nursery rhyme play, and he put us through these psychological and emotional, you know, exercises that just, for what purpose and for what point and for what, you know, Anyway, so yes, there are, and everybody learns differently, and everybody, you know, my masterclass is going to be about this, that like how different people approach acting and how not every actor is the same, but we really do need to be cautious about, you know, especially when we have them connect more and more and more with these characters, finding also ways to, you know, for Les Mis, a lot of the kids like made playlists that they would listen to on the way into rehearsal, or and then that they would listen to on the way out of rehearsal.
Yeah,
as a way to get into the world and a way to get out of the world.
Way.
Yeah,
yeah.
So just finding those little, those little saving graces that can help you remain sane.
Yeah. No, and I think so. I mean, this has been such an awesome conversation because we've gone through so many things, and I want to. So we kind of are segueing into, like, students and, like, individual actors. And I want to talk about that very briefly. But before we do, so for any directors out there that are, like, struggling on point of view and how to enter into a show. So I would love if you have any advice for them.
Mm-hmm.
My piece of advice is that your, like, way into a show should never be to, like kind of what that director did with the Mother Goose thing, to, like, push a student in a, like, an acting exercise, like that's not the place for this. Like your point of view needs to be rooted in some kind of higher calling or some kind of like deeper meaning.
Yeah.
And to find that, and if you can't find that, this is not being like, you should hire me. This is being a true, honest, like, please email me. I would love to talk to you. That like, that is like my favorite thing to do is like find the higher calling in freaking Rock of Ages or something.
Right.
So yeah, what is your advice for people who are trying to like find that point of view or encourage them to?
Well, it's interesting because I sometimes get to choose my own shows, but I work for a lot of organizations who will approach me and say, this is the show we're doing for this particular partner season. Would you want to direct it? And so if it's a show that I am putting forward, usually it's because I've already like found, and I will not lie, like Les Mis was presented to me, but it had been on my list for a really long time wanting to tell that story in that way, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I've had stories where I've had to be like, oh, do I have a point of view on this? What do I want to do with this story? Mm-hmm. And there have been a few that I have, that I've turned down. I still don't know how to direct, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Because it underserves the majority of my actors, which is female identifying.
Yeah.
And I am tired of making them dress up as
boys
and play men. And, you know, I like them to be able to have, you know, be kick-ass and awesome in presenting as they want to present. And sometimes that means that they want to present as male. And sometimes they're like, no, I'd like to present as female. But that story is really hard for me because I still don't know how to do those 12 brothers without it being, you know, 12 young women in in dumb beards. And then the roles for that are written for women are literally a set dressing.
Right.
So I've not quite figured that one
out
yet. That's
fair.
So one answer is that not every show is going to be for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had to learn that. Like I have directed shows that I have not felt a connection to and I have not felt great about how, like that the process went as fine as it could, but I had nothing to say really.
Yep.
And I feel like that showed when it came down to it. The and other it, thing, well, yeah,
you know, because it also really shows when you pick a show just to make money.
Yes.
It's just as obvious. So
yes.
Just want to throw that out there. Go for it.
But the other thing is I try to approach each new thing with like curiosity and as though even if it's a story that I've read a million times, I try to reread it thinking, okay, where is the world right now? Mm-hmm. Where am I right now? Where are my students right now? And then approach it with curiosity and a sense of play to see if any themes can come up that maybe were hiding there all along and I just never saw them.
Yes.
Right? And finding the way, I'll tell you that my go-to, and that's just because of who I am as a human person, my goal as a theater artist and as a practitioner of the theater arts is that I think that empathy will save the world. It's the only thing that can. And that the best way to foster and encourage the practice of empathy, because it is a practice, it's something that takes time and you have to make choices and you have to, you know, and that you can foster that, because all theater is put yourself in somebody else's shoes. It's the magic if. What would happen if I were this person, and if these were my circumstances, and if I had grown up like this? And so I usually approach it at the very base minimum of, what does this story teach me about how we can look through the eyes of other people and how we can hear their stories? And that's a go-to theme if I need one, because also it's prevalent in all, you know, that's, it's the very base root of human beings. Our desire is to be heard, to be understood, and to be seen. We want to be understood, and feeling like we are not is what causes the most pain in our lives and in the world. And the reason that we argue and the reason that we clash is because you don't see my point of view and you can't understand where I'm coming from, and I don't see where you're
And that's what most music, like most shows, are about, like at their core.
So finding the way to tell that legitimately and truthfully and honestly, and then hopefully you connect to another, you know, purpose on top of that. And but yeah, and also it's hard because I can't just say, like, just don't do every show that goose comes to you, because that's not always possible. We have so many things that are put on us. And I will say, one of the things is, there have been times where I've been asked to do a show that I struggle with, that has material that I just don't know how, like, that's going to be a struggle with the students, and that it's going to involve difficult conversations. How do we tell this part of the story? And at the end of the day, I would rather be the one to help them through that story, even if it's a story that I struggle with as well, to take them through that problematic moment, than have them be with somebody who won't talk about it at all and doesn't see any, you know, like, and I don't, and
doesn't see it as a problem.
That I don't think that I am the only person, like, it's not like I'm the only one that can do it. But, like, if I know that it's something that I can help process through and struggle with, I would rather actively do that with them than have them go through and not analyze anything and not question anything and just take everything that's written as face value and, you know, carousel forever.
Which, oh my gosh, even carousel, though, like, I was reading a book this last summer, Strike Up the Band by Scott Miller, which is, like, my favorite theater history textbook, and his analysis of Carousel, like, totally changed my mind, although I still don't love it. But yeah, that's a, but I think that's really, the way that you talked through that. And I think that if you aren't willing as a director to have those conversations, you can't do it. And so there's so many directors out there that don't think that that's an issue. And that's not okay. I just got into, like, a fun Facebook fight about it a couple weeks ago. Not a Facebook fight, just more like talking to somebody and them constantly just coming up against a wall. I'm like, well, if you're not, if you don't even realize that that's problematic and you're not even going to address it. Or if it's even worse, if, like, you realize it's problematic and you won't address it.
If you do Grease, if you do Grease and you don't talk about how Grease is problematic with your students and why it's problematic with your students.
Just don't.
Don't do Grease.
Like, I was just talking to somebody who told me that their director did Grease, their high school, and they changed, but the director was so uncomfortable with Grease Lightning that they changed some of the lyrics, which, besides the fact, is illegal. Like, guys, if you have to change lyrics or lines in your show, like, just don't do it. I know, this is also the end of the podcast, so, like, what do I do now, Lindsay? Don't worry. I will talk about this so much in the spring, because I know all of you guys are going to be selecting shows, like, come April-ish time. We will definitely circle back to that, of how to do that. But, yeah, that's really great advice for people on how to enter into point of view. And before we go, so Kate is going to be teaching a masterclass for Free Theater. Yeah, on February 23rd.
It's so true.
Which is very exciting, which is next week. So if you are listening, so Kate is doing, so we talked a little bit about, she already talked a little bit about, like, how she thinks we should care for young actors and that sort of thing. But, like, what is this class going to be about? So I know we talked about point of view today, but I think that they kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And how do you care for your students?
Yeah. So primarily, we're gonna talk about how to create a room that encourages risk-taking and, you know, we can't keep our rooms, quote unquote, safe because, like, that is an impossible task, like, in terms of, like, you know, I like to say things like, let's protect our hearts.
Well, I think you just, yeah, it's great.
I like to say things like, I like to, you know, protect people's hearts, but, like, that's an impossibility. But that doesn't mean I can't do everything in my power to make sure that we have as safe a room as possible.
Right, totally.
Both in the way that the actors treat each other and in the way that I treat them. But I also want to talk about the fact that one of the ways we can take care of our actors is realizing that they all come to us from different points of view and different mm-hmm. backgrounds and different experience levels, and that the one size fits all style of acting may not fit, and that we have to find way, you may have to work a little harder to connect with students, knowing that not everybody approaches the work the same way, much the same way that there are people who are visual learners, or they're auditory learners, or they're more verbal in learning, tactile. There are different ways of approaching character that can vary from student to student, but also vary based on the show, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to approach a character the same way if you're doing Molière as you are if you're going to be doing, like, Hamilton, right? Like, similarities,
right.
Absolutely,
yeah.
But also different prep work, or Annie. And so we'll talk a little bit about creating characters from the outside in mm-hmm. and from the inside out.
Awesome.
And so how some people, it helps them to sort of figure out, like, what this character looks like, and that helps me connect into their inner working. Or I need to know their brain and their heart, and then that exterior comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And different sort of ways of approaching how we have them analyze their text, because text analysis, there it is, works really well for some people and can be a nightmare for others, especially people who have a struggle with some sort of why can't I think of the word? Oh my gosh. Dyslexia I've definitely run into that uncomfortable moment where early on in my process where it was like, well, why aren't you doing this text analysis work? Oh, you struggle to read and write. I'm a jerk, right? And so, like, finding other ways and mm-hmm. also, like, fun new ways to connect into characters.
Oh,
like, did you know what's really fun? And I wish I could take credit for this, but the students that I'm working with currently in this show about high school students, they all created Instagram pages for their characters.
Oh, my gosh. I was wondering.
Amazing.
I've seen so many random Instagram pages
Correct.
Popping up right
yes.
now, and they're all, like, talking, but, like, in code-ish.
Yeah.
And okay,
so first and
brilliant.
Foremost, we had a quick get together as soon as we found out about it to say thank you, what great work, love your drive, and then just making sure that it didn't stray beyond, you know, that what we see in character can also. We talked about the fact that when you're teasing somebody, face to face, you can see when you've gone too far. When you're teasing somebody character over the internet, you may hit a soft spot for that actor that you didn't know existed. And because you can't see them,
mm-hmm.
you're just going to keep poking at that soft spot until it becomes a bruise.
Ooh.
And they were so on board with understanding that. And also, I think we're relieved that we were like, yes, how amazing that you're doing this. Let's just make sure to be cool about it, everybody.
Right.
But it led me to be like, hell. Oh, yep. I said hell. I did it. heck to the hell. Yeah. Why not use that as a form of connecting into your character and how would they present themselves? Like, and it led me to how do they present themselves in the Instagram version versus what is their inner life? Like, what don't they show?
Yeah.
So, different ways of approaching to connect with these kiddos, y'all.
I love it. Yes. I think it's going to be an awesome class. I'm always looking for new character development techniques. Like, I feel like, I mean, I'm a super. like Stanislavski person.
I don't know, like, and I don't know.
But I'm like, oh gosh, you know, I can't wait to take the class too, just because I want some more, just different techniques to use. And you've been like talking to me about the new things that you've been discovering and learning. And so I can't wait. And so I hope, if you guys want more information, we're going to put a link in the show notes for you to sign up. We would love to have you join us. It's next Saturday at, I don't remember what time, so I'll put that in the show notes also. But it's next Saturday. If you can't attend us live, that's okay, because we pre-record it. And then you can also ask us questions ahead of time and live during the class. So it'll be, it's going to be a great time. And come join us. And Kate, I'm sure you're going to be on many more times on the podcast, unless you've hated
Stop it. It's literally just been like we're hanging out like we normally do.
He's on a microphone, then my husband's in the next room recording us.
All we ever do is talk about theater.
Yeah, and we're a little bit nicer too on here. So that's always good, because then we can be nice. But no, thank you so much for joining me. I hope that if educators, if you're listening, or theater makers, and you have questions about what like point of view or anything like that, or you have thoughts, like please let us know. Start them in the comments. We will definitely address them in future episodes. But thank you all so much for joining. Make sure to subscribe and rate and like if this was an awesome podcast. And we'll be back again with another awesome episode. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're out there and you are struggling and feeling alone in making art that matters, or maybe you're ready to start the journey, I invite you to join us at ReTheater. ReTheater is an online theater and education company whose goal is to inspire educators, communities, and young artists to make art that matters. We have so many ways for you to get involved, from tech talks to masterclasses, mini retreats online, and even a dedicated online community just for educators. You can find out more at www.retheaterco.com. Go there, find out all the awesome ways that you can join us, and we'll see you next time.